This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is poet Linda Paston. Her most recent book is in my hand, just out from Norton. It's called The Last Uncle. Here's Linda.
This poem is called Women on the Shore. The pills I take to postpone death are killing me, and the healing journey we pack for waits with its broken airplane, the malarial hum of mosquitoes. Even the newly mowed domestic grass hides fault lines in the earth which could open at any time and swallow us. In Edvard Munch's woodcut, the pure geometry of color, an arctic sky, the luminescent blues and greens of water, surrounds the woman in black whose head is turning to a skull. If death is everywhere we look, at least let's marry it to beauty.
That's Linda Paston. She's the author of 10 other books of poetry as well, and Carnival Evenings, New and Selected Poems, was a finalist for the National Book Award. She was the Poet Laureate of Maryland, and she's going to tell us all about her journey from childhood to poethood in this 1 hour. I'm holding in my hand your most recent book, and I say to myself, and I've read everything you've ever written since the 60s, I guess. What do you say characterizes this book or makes it very different from any of the others? If you were just to describe, well, what's this book about?
Well, maybe it's because this year I had a 70th birthday that I've been preparing for the last 10 years, and I think this book focuses more on aging and on how the aging remember the past as if it's happening just at the moment and anticipating what's ahead. I think in some ways it's a quieter book than some of my others, but not too quiet, I hope.
Well, you make memory something respectable for us because anybody can use it, but I think it is your trademark. The way that you remember in a way no one else does. And a credit on the back of the book from the New York Times Book Review says that your unfailing mastery of your medium holds the darkness firmly in check. I loved that. It makes us less afraid. The things you talk about that we are afraid of, that we long for and that we yearn for, it's in your hands. We say Linda is taking care of this. She's in charge of birth and death. Somebody's got to do it. Linda Paston is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are so happy to have her. She has published numerous volumes of poetry and has won many, many awards. Her poems also have been in the best periodicals in the country, the Atlantic Monthly, the New Yorker, the New Republic, the Georgia Review, Poetry, Paris Review. Let's have another poem.
This poem is called Practicing. I think it's self-explanatory. Practicing. My son is practicing the piano. He is a man now, not the boy whose lessons I once sat through, whose reluctant practicing I demanded, part of the obligation I felt to the growth and composition of a child. Upstairs, my grandchildren are sleeping, though they complained earlier of the music which rises like smoke up through the floorboards, coloring the fabric of their dreams. On the porch, my husband watches the garden fade into summer twilight, flower by flower. It must be a little like listening to the fading diminuendo notes of Mozart. But here, where the dining room table has been pushed aside to make room for the second or third hand upright, my son is playing the kind of music it took him all these years and sons of his own to want to make.
People compare you to Emily Dickinson. What do you make of that?
It's lovely to hear. I can't
believe
that it's accurate.
What can you possibly say when they talk about that? Because they're not talking about form and style
right.
And content. They're talking about something else. What do you think that could be?
Well, it's partly compression. My poems get compressed out of their lives. I mean, they start as long two-page poems and end up as 12 or 13 lines. I think it's we each led a very domestic life. I live out in the country. I'm home alone most days, as she was. But
it is also the metaphysical precision of your work, I think.
Well, I hope so.
With such a scarcity of words, and I believe that's part of it. But it's about your sensibilities, and I can't think of a better thing to have said about someone. I mean, after all, she is our icon for American culture. So that must feel very, very good.
It does feel good.
Yeah. Linda Paston is here. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I can't think of any place I'd rather be or anybody I'd rather hear read. So we're talking about The Last Uncle, and we're going to go back into that book.
This poem is called Tears, and I actually wrote it, or part of it, at the ophthalmologist's office. I start with a quote from Matthew Arnold, "Save us from tears that bring no healing." Tears. When the ophthalmologist told me gravely that I didn't produce enough tears, I wanted to say, but I cried too much and too often at airports and weddings and sunsets, at movies where the swell of sentimental music forces open my tear ducts like so many locks in a canal. And when he handed me this vial of artificial tears, I wanted to tell him about Niobe. Perhaps if her tear ducts had been deficient, she wouldn't have dissolved into salty water after the loss of her children. Maybe other heroes and heroines, deprived of the resident ability to cry, would have picked themselves up and acted sensibly. Othello, for instance, who wept before he killed her into Desdemona's embroidered pillow. And so I take this bottle of distilled grief and put it in the back of a drawer, but I don't throw it away. There may be poems in the future that need to be watered, for I still remember Tennyson, who wrote of how short swallow flights of song dip their wings in tears and skim away.
Linda Paston, how many of us have held that bottle of artificial tears in our hand, but who wrote the poem about it? That's right. Linda has published other books of poems, and I'm going to just tell you the few titles. A Perfect Circle of Sun, Aspects of Eve, The Five Stages of Grief. I think that brought you to national fame, Five Stages of Grief.
Well, one of the things that makes me feel as if maybe I'm not wasting my life, which I sometimes feel as if I am doing, is that the poem, particularly the title poem, The Five Stages of Grief, is used by so many grief counselors and in grief classes that I feel as if I'm really helping somebody.
Where poetry keeps the tree from growing crooked, as Victor Jara said, when it reaches out into the world and heals things, that is one of them. Another book is Waiting for My Life, PM/AM, New and Selected Poems. Another is A Fraction of Darkness, The Imperfect Paradise, Heroes in Disguise, An Early Afterlife, and then Carnival Evening, which was not so long ago, a couple of years ago, 1998.
Right.
And that was the finalist for the NBA, National Book Award. So you are what we call a practicing poet, truly a woman who is a poet in America and does that. She doesn't teach it. She doesn't present it, run around peddling it, market it. She writes poetry. I cannot think of 10 people who are poets who do this solely. Robert Bly, perhaps. W.S. Merwin, maybe. So let's hark back to your beginnings and see what made you who you are before we go to the next poem. Linda Paston, a little girl, I see her as contemplative, carrying her books, devoted to a mother with a father who is much older. You called it a May-September marriage. So tell us about that little girl and what she discovered, how she discovered language as her paradigm.
Well, I was a really very unhappy, lonely child. my parents were very busy. I didn't have any siblings. And the only company I had was the company of the characters in books. And so I became a compulsive reader. And eventually, just reading became not quite enough. I wanted to respond to what I was reading so that it would be more of a dialogue. And I started writing short stories, poems, little memoirs when I was 11 or 12.
11.
And never stopped.
And do you have those?
I have some of them. My mother kept some of them, yes.
We have to say that Rachel Paston is a very accomplished fiction writer.
Yes.
And she's seen her work published.
Oh, she's been published a lot and won prizes, and she's just finishing a novel and is writing a few poems,
is
too,
she 30
which is
yet?
Really fun. Yes, she's 35.
Uh-huh. And so she actually, this is her profession.
Yes.
She's her mother's daughter.
Yes.
A few poems.
Yes.
How do you like them?
They're wonderful.
Linda Paston, I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're back together again. For a very long time, it's been. Linda has been on The Poet and the Poem, I would say, several times since we began in 1977, and she is a big winner on our show. She was the recipient of the Dylan Thomas Award, the Pushcart Prize, the D. Castagnola Award from the Poetry Society of America, and we would be here very late if I read them all, but has received grants from NEA and the Maryland Arts Council, and this is the way a poet lives. So, at that age, did you ever imagine that poets were living creatures, they weren't just all dead people that you read? Did you ever see yourself in that community or imagine yourself in that fabric of life as a child?
Absolutely not. I didn't think poets were real people.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't readings the way there are now with poets
true.
Coming into the schools, into the communities, nothing like that. The first poet I ever heard read and actually saw was in college, T.S. Eliot, which was quite a way to begin. But still, he didn't seem quite human
right.
when he was reading there. So, no, I did it as something just solitary.
But through high school,
mm-hmm.
an English teacher must have said, you know, you are pure silk. Must have patted you on the head.
Oh, they did. I mean, I had a poem on the back of our high school graduation little booklet. But then I went to Radcliffe, and they had wonderful literature courses, but at that time, very little writing, and I couldn't get any professors to even look at poems. I mean, you were in a class with 1,000 people, and I got a wonderful education, and I don't regret it. But it didn't help me with my poetry.
No poets in residence at that time.
Not that I knew of. I think MacLeish must have been there,
yes.
but there was
mm-hmm.
no way that I would have approached him.
To this day, though, do they change?
It's changed somewhat. Yes, there were some good writing courses when my daughter was there.
And then Brandeis.
Brandeis, I got master's. I was actually on my way to a PhD, but my husband had to move to New Haven for an internship, and I had to leave with him because in those years, one did that. At Brandeis, I worked with a poet named J.B. Cunningham on a one-to-one personal sort of tutorial. I didn't even know he was a poet. He would assign me something in a form every week, and I would write it for him, and it was the most wonderful education, and only later did I find out what a terrific poet he was.
Because he was so modest.
Modest. He was a very arrogant, difficult man, but modest about his own
work. He did not bring out his own work. I just
no.
can't really stand it when teachers teach their own poetry.
I know.
You know? But that's a remarkable.
Yeah.
So your master's was in English then?
Yes.
Not
yes.
such a thing as MFAs in those
no,
days.
No.
Those
it's an English literature.
New phenomena, aren't they, the MFA?
Yeah.
And so there you are, married to a doctor.
There I am.
A scientist.
Having to leave my education to go to New Haven, where there was nothing for me in those years. Yale wouldn't take anyone part-time. Women were not allowed in the Yale library.
I was not allowed to go to Princeton when I graduated
right.
from high school. I had to go to New Jersey State.
Well, what happened was that I stopped writing for almost 10 years. I had babies, and I did a lot of reading, and finally, when just before my third child was born in 1965, my husband said that he was tired of hearing what a good poet I would be if I had only not married him.
Kvetching.
And we decided to make a schedule where I would have a couple of hours every day to write, and I've not stopped.
That was the Cultural Revolution, too, in the 60s.
Yeah.
And so that's when you blossomed. Linda Paston is here. She's our guest. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to ask her for another poem.
This is a poem about my granddaughter. It's called Bess. When Bess, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, waited for her highwayman in the poem I learned by breathless heart at 12, it occurred to me for the first time that my mild-eyed mother Bess might have a life all her own, a secret past I couldn't enter except in dreams. That single sigh of a syllable has passed like a keepsake to this newest child, wrapped now in the silence of sleep. And in the dream I enter, I could be holding my infant mother in my arms, the same wide cheekbones, the name indelible as a birthmark.
What was your relationship to your mother?
I was very close to my mother, particularly as an only child. And it's been, 15 years since she died.
I knew her.
Still
I
very,
met her.
Very hard
I was very shocked. Yeah, when I reread this book this week and remembered knowing her, a lovely spirit, and then you talked about her body, which was ravishing, and yet you willed her to keep living. The reason I asked that question was not to get a psychobabble take on you, but because it is in your work. The devotion and the reverence is in the page. The love, I know your father adored you, but the distance was there also. I find that on the page, more with your father. And so these things are integral, and they're not gossip, because you are very candid about your soul's journey, and your parents are very much in this.
Right.
The last uncle, of course, is so prophetic, and that is the title of this book. Family is everything to you. You continue the legacy with your own three children and your grandchildren. And that's why they say you hold the darkness firmly in check, things we can believe in. Let's go further and farther.
Well, I think I'll read that book that ends with my mother, called Another Autumn, particularly since today is a very almost autumn day. Another autumn, the dogwoods turning first, their hard berries bright as drops of blood in the oak woods, where a wild fox limped past just yesterday, a harsher bleeding, and the sound of hounds came faint as a scent on the wind, barred, I had thought, from this wilderness of suburbs. I looked out my kitchen window this morning and saw a deer, tame as some neighbor's dog, eating the rhododendrons, and I listened for the small thunder of shotguns to stop that beautiful, omnivorous mouth. The cold will come on fast now. Last week I emptied the closet of its summer dresses. Draped over my arms, they were pale and insubstantial as last spring's flowers, and the wool sweaters and skirts I hung in their place depressed me with their heaviness, their dull nut colors. This is the true start of the year. The Jewish calendar knows it, the school calendar too. Maybe that's why our old dreams come back to taunt us, hanging before our faces like condensed breath on this chilly air. My parents married in fall, a May-September union. Now, in the crystalline light of that anniversary, the same questions repeat their old refrains. Was love enough even then? Will we survive another winter? I remember how my mother in her middle age looked at my father, knowing he would be the first to go, and how I looked at her the last autumn of her life, wanting her to flee that ravished flesh, but willing her to stay.
That line has a light around it, how she must have her whole life known that she would remain and be at some time alone. That has permeated my thought lately when I reread that poem. Do you think that was a daily knowledge she carried with her?
I don't. She was a very, not sunny person, but optimistic person in many ways. I don't think she really dwelled on it until later in life.
Linda's given readings at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, the University of Pennsylvania, Cornell, many, many places all over the country, the Library of Congress, the Folger Shakespeare Library. She is with us today at the Library of Congress on The Poet and the Poem. In fact, I remember being at a meeting with you some years ago, and you said, well, I've got to go now. I have to go to Kalamazoo. I said, what's in Kalamazoo? I'm reading there. So you do go all over the country upon invitation.
Yes.
And what do you find there? Is it, I know that it's fun to do that. It's great to be admired and to be invited. What do you find for yourself when you do that?
Well, writing is such a solitary occupation. I mean, I'm home alone all the time with my blank page. And if I travel, which is about once a month, at least I get out into the world. I see that there are real people out there reading the poems. It makes it much more real to me. And the young people at colleges are really, that's when they're really interested in poetry. I don't know why they lose it, and so many of them do. But it's very invigorating.
What do they ask of you?
They want to talk about what it's like to be a poet. They want to know how to get published. They want to ask specific questions about specific poems. I try to always have a question session after reading, and after the first person gets up the courage to ask a question, they don't stop coming.
You've been called truly one of the most important poetic talents now publishing. That's a big deal, because there are more poets than ever before. Good ones. Hundreds and thousands of really good poets publishing.
It's one. I mean, on the
it's
other
a
hand,
bonanza.
The poets are the main readers of poetry, so it means as we expand as writers, we get a whole new group of readers.
But too. To be at the top of the heap is not bad for Linda Preston either. And so let's hear a poem, one of the poems that has brought you there.
Well, perhaps I'll read an earlier poem if it's something that brought me there.
This is from Carnival Evening.
This is, well, I have poems from all of the books in Carnival Evening, since it's new and selective poems. This poem is called Ethics, and it comes from 12 years at an ethical culture school where we had ethics classes every week.
Wow.
Ethics. In ethics class, so many years ago, our teacher asked this question every fall. If there were a fire at a museum, which would you save? A Rembrandt painting, or an old woman who hadn't many years left anyhow. Restless on hard chairs, caring little for pictures or old age, we'd opt 1 year for life, the next for art, and always half-heartedly. Sometimes the woman borrowed my grandmother's face, leaving her usual kitchen to wander some drafty, half-imagined museum. 1 year, feeling clever, I replied, why not let the woman decide herself? Linda, the teacher, would report, eschews the burdens of responsibility. This fall, in a real museum, I stand before a real Rembrandt, old woman, or nearly so, myself. Colors within darker than autumn, darker even than winter. The browns of earth, though earth's most radiant elements burn through the canvas. I know now that woman and painting and season are almost one and all beyond saving by children.
That's a very famous poem. And what reports have you gotten back from that one?
Oh, people really do like that poem.
Everyone loves that poem. It sums it up. And many of your poems are taught, remembered, beyond what you know. That interests me. You have no idea that you put it out there and where it is ending up. And I told you I was teaching at a huge convention where we had 500 in each session, and they spoke of your work as classic and used examples of it to teach people who were introducing themselves into the world of poetry. And I thought, Linda doesn't even know this is happening. And it's like it's an illusion that you sometimes enter and see your image coming back at you. But it's a very interesting life you lead. Autonomy comes to mind with you, because your clarity is a form of autonomy.
That's interesting.
It is almost a way of remaining extremely private. To be so clear is to say, you don't need to come any closer than this, because here it is. And it's a marvelous way of keeping yourself unto yourself. It's quite the other way around from thinking that you're just letting it all slip out. So that is a word that cropped to mind. I wonder, I was reading the new book, Women of the 21st Century, and they're language poets, and they're experimental poets, Ray Armantrout, Claudia Rankine, Susan Howell. Do you like to read poetry of disparate elements, even though you don't like to feel like writing that?
Absolutely, and one of the nice things about being in so many literary journals is when they send them to me, I open them and I read the whole thing.
You do?
And I do, rather rapidly, but it's a way of learning new people that I wouldn't have heard of otherwise. And then if something really strikes me, I go get their book. That's what happened a number of years ago with Billy Collins. He and I were on opposite pages, and I think it was the Georgia Review, and I wrote him a fan note. I'd never heard of him. And crossing that was a letter that he had written to me asking me to come to read in his series. And it was such fun when he later became, you know, so popular.
You introduced yourself through that book.
Yes, yeah.
And you too do have similarities. And one of them is we understand you're saying, but it is never what it appears to be, and that there is always a veil that one can lift and another veil you can lift at the next reading, so that you you don't give it all away at once. It is elegant restraint, but there's something for everyone, and I think Billy Collins and you are very alike about that. Also, the way he borders on humor and tragedy very lightly. You walk that fine line yourself. So we would like to hear it more in poetry now. Let's stay with the old book, the old books, because they're compressed. How many of them? 10 between two covers?
Yeah.
10 Carnival Evenings. Was the first book out in 68?
I think it was 70, 71. I started seriously writing again in 65.
Mm-hmm. Linda Paston is here. She's our guest. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to ask her for another poem. What would you like to read to us from this book?
Well,
this was National Book Award stuff.
Why don't I read the poem Fall in the Literary Review, which this is one of the reviews that I was in with another poet that I knew, which is always fun. Fall in the Literary Review. Though we're pages apart this time, just being in the same issue is like being at a party together. You in your semi-formal attire, me with my ragged lines, somber again, but willing to share a drink or two, even to exchange a literary joke. And because we won't ever meet, because the only sheets we'll share are pages in a magazine, you don't mind how old I am, and I don't care what you look like or if you're married, as your poem this time implies. I don't even care who the lucky you is you keep addressing. I like to think it's me.
Carnival Evening. And that's done pretty well. It's now in paperback.
Yes.
Just out in paperback. That's Norton, too, right?
Yes.
Are you solely Norton?
Yes. My first book was Swallow Press, A Perfect Circle of Sun, and then Live Right did my second book, but Norton bought Live Right, and
right.
They've been doing me ever since.
Right. Who is your editor?
My editor now is Jill Bialowski, who's a wonderful editor and a poet herself.
And does not meddle with you?
No, she doesn't meddle. She just helps.
And does she say this one should go before that one?
She has never done that.
Well, what is she getting paid for?
Oh, she she helps with the production of the book, and I don't know. She
makes
she's
the book.
A cheerleader.
She makes the book.
She's wonderful.
So Linda Paston's new book is available through Norton, and I think it will keep you very warm this winter if you buy it. She has a great picture on the back page, and so I want to know who this Margareta Mitchell is.
She's a California photographer, and after I gave a reading at Berkeley for that Robert Haas had arranged, she asked if she could take my picture for an anthology of poets and their pictures and poems that she was starting to put together.
Mm.
And so I went to her house, and she was wonderful.
Has that come out yet?
No, it hasn't.
And something else which has just come out is a book of Linda Paston in Chinese.
Yes.
Now,
instead of illustrations, on one side is the poem in English, and the other side is it's in Chinese, and it's so beautiful to look at, even though I don't understand, you know. Any Chinese, just to look at it, it's like a design.
Can you learn Chinese from the way Brodsky learned English?
No. No, I have no talent in foreign languages. I'm
oh,
afraid.
Really?
Mm.
Ah.
I speak some French, but it's not a natural gift.
Someone wrote you from China and said...
It was a professor in a Taiwanese university who spent a year in this country as a visiting professor and came upon my poems and started translating them. And then he got in touch with me and asked if they could do a whole book. And he came out to Potomac and visited and took pictures and interviewed me.
How many poems are in the book?
Oh, there must be about 30, something like that.
Do you feel that he chose poems that are significantly yours? I mean, that you would have chosen the 30 favorites, all-time hits or something?
Not particularly. I mean, every time I have to choose poems for a new and selected, I choose different poems, so it's very hard to choose among one's children, so to speak. But he made a good selection, I think.
And it's just come. Will it be on the shelves here?
I have no idea. I doubt it.
It's another world, isn't it? Global poetry is so out of range. You don't have any control over it.
Right.
It's probably going to sell in China.
I hope so. There apparently it's been reviewed in China.
What is the title?
They're calling it, I think, after my To a Daughter Leaving Home poem. I think it's To a Daughter Leaving Home, which is interesting.
Very
interesting. And the picture on the cover is a young girl on a bicycle, which is what that poem is about.
So every time there is a lull in the conversation in your life, and it looks as if, well, you have a poem called Fame, where we are all quickly forgotten.
That's right.
And something crops up, doesn't it?
Should I read To a Daughter Leaving Home, which is the
that would be
poem
excellent.
That they
that would be excellent.
Chose as the title
Linda
poem.
Paston, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
To a Daughter Leaving Home. When I taught you at 8 to ride a bicycle, loping along beside you as you wobbled away on 2 round wheels, my own mouth rounding in surprise when you pulled the head down the curved path of the park, I kept waiting for the thud of your crash as I sprinted to catch up, while you grew smaller, more breakable with distance, pumping, pumping for your life, screaming with laughter, the hair flapping behind you like a handkerchief waving goodbye. There are 2 things that are interesting about that poem that you can't tell from looking, from hearing it. One is that it's all one sentence. I wanted the reader to become a little breathless the way I was when I was running after my daughter, although I wasn't really, because I think it was Robert Frost who said that poetry lies in order to tell the truth. The lie in this poetry was that I never taught my daughter to ride a bicycle. Her father did that.
At least you didn't start with I remember, which you say is the greatest fiction of all.
Right.
Any poem
right.
that starts with I remember. But you do have a poem where you taught a child to drive in a car that is now rusting in the fields. Is that a lie also in service of truth?
Yes.
Of course. Yes. Linda yes. Paston. Okay, we're moving on. We heard from the last uncle. We have been hearing from Carnival Evening. Is there another poem from your past that you can share?
RSVP, Regrets Only. I regret that I can't come. I regret the moment we met and the way you pretended. I regret the sun that day, its warmth so artificial, and I regret the way pain has taught me nothing. I regret this invitation, its phony formality, its ink coming off like sin on my clean fingers. Since the day I met you, I regret everything.
That poem is deceptively simple. I have a feeling it took a very long time to write. No.
You're wrong.
It came out?
It came out.
That's the way it was.
Mm-hmm. It was one of the quickest poems I've ever written.
That's really, I said to myself, you know, each one of these things is so carefully regretful that she must have had a whole panoply to choose from. And so she spent a long time thinking of the exact thing. Huh, you really did regret it, Teresa. Feel better afterwards. That's been that was one of the poems taught in a huge session. I was teaching, and the co-worker said that was his classic favorite poem. Somebody you never knew, a poet, a PhD, you'll never meet. I find that interesting. Linda has been a teacher at the Bread Loaf Writers Conference. Well, on the staff is not exactly sitting in the classroom teaching, but it is guiding young poets and writers, and that has been going on for a very longer. Well, since John Chardy.
Oh, even before John
Chardy. When was
Chardy.
That? What year did that? Must have been the 40s then.
Yeah.
And you were in residence for 20 years, that's every
right,
August,
right.
in Bread Loaf, and now Michael Collier, who's the Poet Laureate of Maryland, is the director of that.
Yes.
And what was that experience like for you? You go for 2 weeks?
It was
like being a guru?
It was the best experience of my life.
Really?
Particularly the first year when I came as a fellow. There's this real hierarchy you can be. A student there,
yeah.
you can be a student there with or without poems,
mm-hmm.
then a scholar, a fellow, a staff assistant, and finally staff. I think Michael has tried to make that hierarchy less hierarchical. I came as a fellow just after my first book was out, and I had never met any other poets, and I had never left home for 2 weeks. I asked my mother to come to stay and help out because Rachel, my youngest, was 12.
Now, who was the director?
Bob Pack.
Oh,
he
right.
was the director through
right.
all the years that I went. And I went to this place where there were several hundred people, and everyone thought that writing and poetry was the most important thing in the world, and all they wanted to do was talk about it, and it was totally intoxicating.
How did they get you home?
I think I cried all the way home. I just didn't ever want to leave, and to have the opportunity to keep coming back every summer was great.
And now, a quarter of a century later, you feel that you've talked enough about poetry? You can take it in smaller doses.
No, it's just my life has become more complicated. I have grandchildren. We spend a lot of the summers together. The direction of Bread Love changed in a very good way, but in a way that included more teaching on a daily basis than I really wanted to do. I have gone back since then as a guest reader, and I would love to do that whenever they could have me back. I love the play.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Our guest is Linda Paston, and we're talking about her, the writer's life, the poet's life, and especially Linda's life. Tell me about not wanting to teach poetry.
Well,
I mean, why do we all have to do it?
Well, mostly to make a living, and I am a beneficiary of the old patriarchal system. My husband makes the living. I mean, I make some money, but certainly not enough to live on. And that I make really from the readings, not from advances on books or anything.
The act of teaching poetry, though, I mean, some poets would do it without pay. Right. Some do regret it and long for time, their sabbaticals, right. You know. But well, the very function of it, how much do you think can be done?
Well, I also taught at American University in their MFA program for several years. And it's not that I don't enjoy it when I'm doing it and feel a real connection with the students, and I think I'm pretty good at it. But I have such a low energy level that I find that when I'm teaching, I don't write. That's the main reason.
That is so true. And I think when you teach your art, you burn out on that. You can only give, you know, you can't have more going out than is coming in. And I bet you didn't get that much writing done when you were at American.
I didn't. The energy comes from the same place. When you're helping students with their poems, it's like revising your own poem, and then you go home and collapse.
Well, I know.